Hello, hello, hello. Good afternoon, everybody. Hey, hey, hey. So, nice rainy day, yes? Yeah. Thanks for coming out. I'm really excited. You all know why we're here. Lauren's going to get up in just a second and speak to us. And I think that the format that we're going to use today is that she's going to speak for 45 minutes to an hour. Not an hour. Over the themes and topics and things from her book. And then we're going to do some Q&A, which she really loves. And so let me invite you to listen in a couple ways. One is just intently to what she's saying, because what she's saying is really great. I don't know how many of you have had the chance to interact with her material as to yet, but for those of us who've the last 4 weeks been in the book study over real sex, we've really had a great time conversing about the content of her book. So listen intently to that. But then siphon off one part of your brain, if you can do that. And as she talks, think about what kind of questions you might want to ask Lauren relative to some of the topics she's doing, so that we can have a really lively and good Q&A in that way. So Lauren comes to us. She has written three books. Her first chronicled her journey to faith called Girl Meets God. She wrote a really great book called Mudhouse Sabbath, where she takes some of the Hebrew spiritual practices. Yes? Jewish, yes, Jewish, and kind of helps us to understand what some of those things are. And then Real Sex has been her most recent book. It's really great. And she comes to us from Raleigh-Durham, where she teaches at Duke Divinity School. So, Lauren, all yours.
Thank you. I haven't done anything yet, so you don't need to clap. But thanks anyhow. Well, it's great to be here. I have known about this church community for some years and have not been here before, so it's really a huge treat for me to be here. And I know there's millions of things in Kansas City that you could be doing at 4 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, even when it's raining, so I am honored that you're here. As Tim said, no one wants to listen to anyone just hold forth for hours and hours on end, so I am going to talk for a little bit, but I get much more energized, and I actually think, frankly, everyone or most people kind of listen better and engage more and learn more and give more during an exchange and not just a lecture. So before we get to that exchange, I know some of you have been reading and discussing the book, and I'm going to assume that some of you haven't. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about how I came to write this book and what I hope that it accomplishes, and then hit one or two of the themes and content that I cover in the book. And then I thought I would say a little bit about something that I actually don't address in the book that I wish that I would have addressed, and if I could go back and add or change some of the things that I would do differently. It is this sort of annoying thing about a book that, unlike, you know, a website, once it's published, there it is. You can't change it too easily. So the book, depending on my mood, is sometimes the sex book and sometimes the chastity book, you know, depending on what mood I'm in. And, you know, my basic assumption when thinking about Christian sexual ethics, I have two basic assumptions. One is that ethics as a category of thinking and a way of being in the world is not just this sort of abstract, ghettoized thing that, like, people study in seminaries. It's actually, I have no academic training in ethics, but that ethics is sort of our modern iteration of what the wisdom literature of Scripture tries to do, and that is to think about and explore and practice how our faith commitments and our communal commitments shape really quotidian, ordinary, everyday things like how we eat and how we sleep and how we have sex and how we drive and where we buy our houses. So to me, that's what ethics is about. And the book is not a memoir. I mean, as Tim said, my first book is a memoir. If I'd written a memoir about my experience with chastity, the book would be even shorter than it is. It's already pretty short. But even though the book is not a memoir, it was born out of an autobiographical imperative. So to give you some life context, I became a Christian when I was about 21. I don't have one of those, like, 10:03 in the morning on January 2nd, 1980, dateable conversion experiences, although they have a venerable tradition in Christianity, and I honor those of you who have had that experience, that my conversion was drawn out over several years. But I give you 21 as the sort of date. So I was in grad school then, in between college and grad school, and I'd had sex in high school, and I'd had sex in college, and I was not married or anywhere close to being married, which didn't stop me from obsessing about marriage a lot, but that topic for another day. And I knew when I became a Christian that Christianity had something to say about this sexual behavior of mine. But I didn't really want to pursue that with a whole lot of vigor because I didn't really want to end up where I suspected Christianity would take me, which is to say that although I was extremely sincere in my conversion and totally besotted with Jesus and really enthusiastic about the church, I continued in pretty willful disobedience in this one area of life for a number of years. I continued in disobedience and still continue in disobedience in a lot of areas of life, but there was a lot of willfulness and a real resistance on my part to thinking about and kind of opening myself up to what the gospel might have to say to me about sex. And in hindsight, I can see that the root sin there was not, you know, sexual sin. The root sin was a kind of secret desire to let Christianity be compartmentalizing and compartmentalized, and a kind of refusal to see that actually the gospel in its most basic sense is a call against compartmentalization and is a call to a kind of whole life with neighbor and with God. So anyway, during this couple of years, I struck this little bargain with God where I said, what can't really be that God doesn't want unmarried people not to have sex. God must just care about people having meaningless sex. And so I decided that I would, in a great act of self-sacrifice, only have sex in that great oxymoron, the committed dating relationship. I think there's no such thing, really. But so for a couple of years, like, people gave me books about this topic, and they invited me to talks, you know, like this one, sort of. And really, none of that had any impact. And I'm an Episcopalian, and it was fairly early in my life as a baptized Christian, within months, really, that I was very drawn to the formal practice that is part of the Episcopal and Catholic tradition of formally saying confession. And because I know that's not everyone's practice, let me just digress for a second to sort of shed light on that. It's my understanding that when one says confession in the company of a priest or clergy person, that one is not confessing to the minister, right? One is confessing to God in the presence, please come in the presence of someone who is there to be the presence of Christ to you in a particular way. And so the priest doesn't forgive you, right? The priest pronounces God's forgiveness to you in rather more audible language than we usually hear in our, you know, quiet time or whatever, I hope. Or at least in more audible language than I usually hear in my quiet time. So I was in the habit of saying confession, and my confessions were pretty much always about two things, prayer and sex. Not enough of one and too much of the other, and I'll leave to your imaginations which was which. And so one day with my confessor, this priest, I was talking about sex with my boyfriend and some like drunken escapade at a party or something. And my priest looked at me and said, well, Lauren, what you're describing is sin. It's sin. And in that most sacramental moment, I heard something that I had not been willing or able to hear before, even though I'm sure he'd said that to me before. So that began for me a journey that I'm sure will be lifelong, which was a journey of turning from what I believe the Christian tradition would describe as sexual sin and recommitting myself to chastity and repenting. And I say lifelong because for me, chastity, which is this most churchy word, right? It's right up there with tithing. In terms of like clunky, churchy words that we tend to avoid. I actually think it's a great word, and I'd like to reclaim it. To me, it means not simply this kind of narrowly focused teaching about how you comport yourself vis-a-vis sex, though it means that. But in general, more broadly, I understand chastity to be the pursuit of faithfully conforming our bodies to the arc of the gospel. And that has a lot to do with sex, but it has a lot to do with a lot of other things too. So we could talk about, you know, where we buy our food and who produces it. And I think that's part of chastity also. And I think it's just really tricky to be an embodied person and faithful. God, I suppose, could have created us just as souls, you know, without bodies, but we were created with bodies. And I find that my body becomes the site of the playing out of my most vexed spiritual struggles. And certainly the arena of sexuality is one manifestation of that. So anyway, I began to write the book in part because I knew this was this really important issue for the Christian tradition, chastity, but I didn't really understand why it was such a big deal, and so I wrote the book to try to teach myself why it was a big deal. And I also wrote the book because of all those millions of books that people had given me, like Passion and Purity, which some of you may also have been given. And if you were, maybe you were given the edition that like has purple lettering, and you know, like Jesus' words in red, Elizabeth Elliot's words in purple. You'd think, like, given that writers fear a reviewer saying this writer uses purple prose, that people would avoid purple typography. But anyhow, so it's given all these books, and I read them because I'm a total bookworm, and the first thing I do whenever I need to figure something out is go to a bookstore and try to read myself into sanity and sense. And they were all fine and well-meaning and, like, more or less biblical. And they all read like they were written for the 19th century. And there I was living in the late 1990s in New York City, unmarried. And these books that made the pursuit of chastity just sound, like, easy and obvious and immediately rewarding and fun didn't really resonate with me at a very deep level. A concrete example of that, and I do mention this in the book, is the great book that I read during these years is Sex for Christians by Lewis Smeeds. Has anyone read that? Terrific book. Smeeds was a professor of ethics at Fuller until he died a couple of years ago. And the book is like about half of it's about non-marital sexuality and half of it's about marital sexuality. It's really, really good. It was written the year that I was born. That doesn't mean that the core message of the book is dated, because the core message is biblical, and I believe that kind of God's vision for the good life as expressed in Scripture doesn't change from decade to decade. But the culture in which Professor Smeeds was writing in 1976, particularly with reference to matters sexual, has certainly changed a lot. So he has a chapter that is devoted in large part to the question of petting, whether unmarried Christians can engage in petting, right? I mean, I don't even know what petting is. Like, that's just not sort of the idiom in which I think our contemporary questions of sexual ethics present themselves. So I decided that I would write this book that would try to be theologically orthodox in matters to do with sex, but would sort of address the culture where we live. And I try to do a couple of things in the book. I'm going to just hit on one centrally, but I try to talk a lot about community, and if you come tomorrow, that's what I'll probably be hitting on. I think in a certain way the book is not about sex. It's really about community, and sex is just sort of the example. It could be a book about money or time or some other practice. I try also to think about how we talk about sex, and this is what I'm going to talk about for a few minutes now. I had this really, like, bright idea. The book, by the way, took me about 6 years to write. And I thought, well, I'll write this chapter in which I analyze the discourses about sex that we get in pop culture, right? So I'll read a couple of issues of Cosmo, and I'll go to some movies, and I'll watch some television shows, even though I don't own a television. And I will analyze the messages that we get about sex from those vehicles of pop culture, and then I will discuss, like, whether those messages about sex are consistent with or in conflict with the message we get about sex from Scripture and the Christian tradition. This proved to actually be the easiest chapter in the book to write, because it is not rocket science to watch an episode of Desperate Housewives and then analyze the extent to which, you know, a married woman fornicating with her pool boy is not completely consistent with the story about sex that we get in the Christian tradition. So it turned out that this is sort of easy work, and of course, this is work that Christians do all the time. There's like no more frequent target in kind of Christian chatter than the degradations of, you know, the surrounding culture's narratives of sexuality. And yet, that doesn't really seem to be all that helpful at the end of the day, right? Partially because it posits this real opposition between church and world that I think most of us don't actually experience on a day-to-day basis. And it also seems not to be helpful based on, like, anecdote and statistic, which is to say that we all know that lots of committed Christians will say that they think that premarital sex is wrong, whatever that means, and that's actually such a... That's a phrase that might be worth unpacking. We can do that in Q&A if people are interested. They think premarital sex is wrong, but then we know that they're having it. And in fact, on the plane here, I had the pre-publication galleys of a new book by Robert Withnow, who's a sociologist of American religion who teaches at Princeton, and he writes about 4 books a year, kind of assessing the state of American religion. And this new book that's coming out in September is completely fascinating, and everyone should read it. It's called After the Baby Boomers. And it is an assessment of the religious lives of Americans between the ages of 21 to 45. And he says that a staggeringly high percentage of self-identified evangelical Christians, something like 97%, would say that they think that premarital sex is wrong. But then, a really easy percentage to remember, 69% of them have had it or are having it. That's why I didn't have to bring the book. The statistic was memorable. So we all know that on the one hand, the church seems to spend a lot of time and energy and institutional energy, like magazines and tape series and curricula, on questions relating to sex. And yet, I think many of us feel that in our real lives, there's a huge gap between the helpfulness and really the authenticity and truthfulness at a deep level of the church's discourses about sex and actually our quotidian day-to-day experiences. So I should just say that I do take as a given when I think and talk and practice matters sexual that this unshakable word about this from Scripture boils down to God having created us with bodies, God being excited about sex and liking sex in its intended context, which is marriage, and then that means, among other things, that we're not supposed to be having sex if we're not married. I really tried for years to get out of that last part, you know, convincingly, and to come up with a good kind of scriptural and orthodox defense of extramarital sex, and I couldn't do it. So that is my sort of framework, and I began in that framework to think, well, perhaps rather than just thinking about, you know, the messages we get from Sex and the City, it would be more important to contemplate and analyze how we talk about sex in the church and in church communities. And I just want to take a few minutes and highlight 3 of the stories that I think we tell a lot in Christian community about sex, and to invite us to sort of reconsider these stories. And there's a theme that runs throughout my critiques of each of these. And the basic theme is that often in the church when we talk about sex, we kind of ghettoize the topic of sex, and we really fail to connect our Christian story about sexuality to any broader and more basic Christian or biblical or theological narrative. And I think that we would do better to sort of constantly try to reconnect what we say and think and practice about sex to what our basic convictions as members of the body of Christ are. So I'll just briefly, these will be familiar to those of you who've read the book, but I'll just briefly hold up 3 stories that we tell about sex in the church that I think are unhelpful and ultimately not true. The first, and this particularly like pervades youth culture, like youth groups and teen culture, and if there's anyone in here who's somehow in youth ministry or hangs out with teenagers a lot, like God bless you, you're doing saints work, I couldn't do it, I'm very glad that you're doing it, and when you do it, try to avoid the following. That is the notion that if you have premarital sex, you will wake up the next morning and feel bad about it. it's a very pervasive message, again, particularly in youth culture, and I think it really boils down to no more than a false emotional scare tactic. So let's just spend a moment on the falsehood part. Sometimes it's true, right, that when you engage in sexual sin, you feel bad about it the next day, right? Sometimes you wake up, instead of feeling bad, instead of feeling like bereft or lonely or guilty, you might wake up feeling like neutral or fine or confused or ecstatic or hungover or there's a whole variety of responses that one might have to, say, having had premarital or adulterous sex, for that matter, right? The problem, it seems to me, with this claim that if you have premarital sex, you're going to feel terrible about it, is not that it's sort of generically false. The problem, it seems to me, is that it's theologically false. And the theological falsehood is an inaccurate and actually somewhat diluted statement about sin and the powerful, pervasive nature of the fall and sin in our lives. So I would suggest that the more authentic and truthful teaching is that actually sin is so pervasive in our lives that even our feelings and our perceptions, our epistemologies, if you want to give it fancy academic speak, even our feelings and epistemologies and perceptions are distorted by sin. And therefore, my feelings about a given encounter, sexual or otherwise, are not completely reliable. It may not be that my feelings are completely useless and false data, right? But my feelings are distorted by sin, and therefore my feelings have to be refined and reconfigured by God, by church, by scripture, by the power of the Holy Spirit. If it were the case that my feelings were totally reliable, I wouldn't really need church or the Bible to give me any indications of, like, how I should be in the world or who to be or what to do. And I think, actually, Scripture is very clear about this. And I would particularly point to a text I've already obliquely referred to, and that is the book of Proverbs. Now, just out of curiosity, like, who in here has, in the last 5 years, devoted any real time to the book of Proverbs? Maybe a third of us, or a quarter, which is actually a pretty high percentage. I think for the most part, many of us don't actually devote any time to the book of Proverbs because we secretly think that it's like a collection of Chinese fortune cookie statements, you know, that somehow made it into the canon. Every couple of years, and this happened recently, there will be like a big news blitz, media blitz, about how religiously ignorant Americans and Brits also are. And in one of these studies, the pollsters like gave people some statements from the book of Proverbs and some of Ben Franklin's aphorisms and asked them to identify which was which, and no one could do it. Even clergy couldn't do it. So I actually would commend the book of Proverbs to you as an incredibly insightful journey through how all these things we say we believe work themselves out in our real life. And one of the chords that the book of Proverbs strikes over and over again is that precisely the way sin works is to tell us that things that are in fact corrosive and destructive for us, things that in fact alienate us from our neighbor and separate us from God, that those things actually feel terrific. So the book of Proverbs tells us that the adulterous woman is in fact bitter as gall, but she seems to be sweet and perfumed and honey-like. And if you go with her or her male counterpart, you are in fact going to the pit, but it feels like you're scaling a mountaintop. So that, it seems to me, is the basis for a better conversation about sex. Not to say, if you do this, you'll feel terrible, but in fact to say what we mean, which is this choice, this behavior, this action is in fact corrosive for you and will in fact remove you from God and your neighbor, but it may feel terrific. And in fact, it may feel like it's drawing you closer to God. But your feelings and my feelings are not wholly reliable data. So that's the first sort of trope or discourse we hear in the church about sex that I think we might want to reconsider more theologically. Two more, and then I'll stop yakking on here. So the second one is the one that really ticks me off, I have to admit, and this, you know, if you've read the book, is the idea that while men are obsessed with sex and think about sex every 7 seconds, as sociologists are always telling us, women just basically don't have sex drives and don't really want to have sex anyway. If you think I'm overstating that, let me just read you one or two snippets from other books that I quote in this book. I read a lot of Christian books and magazine articles about sex while I was writing this. And here are some of the choice quotations. And these were recent. These were not, like, written in the 19th century. So this little quotation comes from a Christian marriage guide co-written by a husband and wife team. It wasn't just written by a clueless man. And this Christian, not that all men are inherently clueless, this Christian marriage guide describes, quote, a young couple very committed to the Lord who are engaged to be married in 2 weeks. So 2 weeks before their wedding, this couple goes to the movies, and then they're done at the movies, and the man drives the woman home and drops her off and, like, kisses her hand chastely or something. And while he is driving home, he prays the following prayer. Lord, there are 2 more weeks that I'll have to restrain myself. I know your grace is sufficient, but if you could just let these 2 weeks zip by, I'd certainly be grateful. So he's praying, obviously, for sort of continued sexual restraint, right? Back at the ranch, the young woman is also praying. She is giving thanks for the marvelous, glorious evening and asking God to help her savor every wedding shower. She cherishes the experience of having eaten... I have to say that I think the authors could not have been Southern, because if they were Southern, they would know that your wedding showers, like, well preceded the 2 weeks before your wedding, because during the 2 weeks before, you're having the sip and see, you know, where everyone comes over to see all your presents. She cherishes the experience of having eaten popcorn out of the same sack at the movies. That's how you know it wasn't written in the 19th century, because there weren't movies then, right? To her, this was such an intimate, special experience that she slipped one of the kernels into the pocket of her sweater so she could press it in her diary. Then the authors ask what accounts for the differences between the man's prayer and the woman's prayer, and they answer their own question by saying, our popcorn story only begins to illustrate the difference in the sexual makeup of men and women. The difference is so immense that it's difficult to define. Now, in point of fact, the difference that those authors are suggesting is not difficult to define. The difference they are suggesting is that men don't have emotions and women don't have sex drives. That is the moral of the popcorn story. That same idea also works its way into books about parenting. How many parents are here? Okay, so maybe you've read some Christian books about parenting, a cottage industry. And so this one book that I'm about to quote from is called something like How to Produce Sexually Pure Children or something like that. And it actually... It begins with a really insightful premise. And the premise is, if one is trying to form one's children in narratives and practices that are, in fact, countercultural, and I would say this doesn't apply only to sex, but it also applies to money and lots of other areas of life, you have to start really early. Like, you cannot sit your kids down at age 15 and have, like, a talk and then hope that'll do the trick, because the advertisers started much earlier. So there's a chapter in this book called, like, What Your Infants Need to Know Age Appropriately About Sex, you know, how to talk to your toddlers age appropriately about sex, your grammar schoolers. And then when the book gets to adolescence, the chapters sex segregate. So we get a chapter called What Girls Need to Know Before They Start Dating, and then a chapter subsequently called What Boys Need to Know Before They Start Dating. And in the girls' chapter, we learn, quote, that from early childhood, girls' fantasies are of Prince Charming and motherhood, not sex. By high school, a boy's sex drive may be the strongest driving force in his mind. While girls may have an increase in libido, their thoughts are about non-sexual socialization, dating, fun, parties, holding hands, and maybe kissing. Every mother should teach her daughter what boys are like. And the rest of the chapter is devoted to explaining that boys are high-octane sexual creatures, and that moms must tell their daughters, and apparently dads are not supposed to have these conversations, with that topic again for another day, moms are supposed to tell their daughters not to fall for a boy's lies or lines, etc. And there's nothing in the chapter that suggests that the mother might also say to her daughter, daughter, you too have a sex drive. That's a good thing. That's part of how you were created. That's part of being embodied. And when you experience that sexual desire, here are some ways to think about disciplining it. That's just not in the chapter. Now, by contrast, the boys' chapter is a set of instructions about, like, taking cold showers, you know, and going running. So the image is that the girl, in order to stay pure, another phrase I find slightly problematic, but basically just has to resist peer pressure and has to just fend off the kind of raging bundle of hormones that will take her to the movies, and while she's kind of romantically obsessing about the popcorn, you know, he's trying to make a move. So, you know, I don't think that this needs a belabored commentary. Suffice it to say that one doesn't have to posit that men and women are identical, and one doesn't even have to posit that men and women experience sexuality identically to diagnose this narrative as false and unhelpful. It's not, in my opinion, all that helpful for men to suggest that men are sort of emotionless beasts who can't actually discipline themselves at all. And then obviously it's not helpful for women, either unmarried women who are given no tools for disciplining sexual desire when they experience it. And I don't think it helps married women to be sort of, should a woman get married, to be formed in this, not just a narrative of like good girls don't, but actually good girls don't even want to. And then, you know, you get married if you do and are sort of expected to flip the switch and become like the domestic sex goddess. And if you don't, it will be your fault when your husband gets addicted to pornography, right? I mean, that's all part of the narrative. Just as an aside, it's interesting to note that historically, in the grand sweep of church history, this is actually a fairly new way of configuring gender, this thing about women not having libidos and men being obsessed with sex drives. Until about the 17th century, most preachers, Christian moralists, even physicians, would have actually said the opposite, based on what I would say is a gross misreading of the Adam and Eve story. They would have said that women are naturally lascivious and naturally wanton and out to kind of trip up Adam, who's naturally kind of God-fearing and upright. For reasons we can discuss, if people are interested, that changes in about the 1600s. So I found actually since writing the book that people get sometimes a little uncomfortable. I don't know why this should surprise me with like naming women as people who are also sexual. I sent a draft of the book when I was mostly finished with it to a bunch of people to read kind of at all different points on a kind of Christian theological spectrum. And I had three friends who happened to all be conservative Presbyterians, two of them pastors and one of them a woman who is married to a pastor, who all wrote back and said, I really like the book, blah, blah. Except for that few pages about women's sex drives, which I can't fully sign on to that, because I do a lot of counseling of married couples in my ministerial life, and I just often see that like 90% of the time or 99% of the time when there's sexual imbalance, you know, the man wants to have more sex and the woman doesn't. So doesn't that tell us that actually there is this essential difference in men and women's sex drives? I'll just add that statistics actually don't bear that out. Actual sort of sociological studies about marital couples' sexual experiences find that in about half of marriages, sexual desire is pretty evenly matched, and in about a quarter of marriages, women want to have more sex, and in a quarter, men want to have more sex. But even if we take these people's reporting at face value of their counseling experiences, sexual desire is a very contingent thing, right? So it's not hard to imagine why a married mother of 2.7 children who has a part-time job as a physician or a teacher's aide or a paralegal or a judge or a full-time job, and then is home doing like the bulk of domestic labor in her household, it's not all that tough to begin to imagine why she might not be like dying to have sex night after night with her husband. And that doesn't actually tell us anything about women's sex drives. And it in particular doesn't tell us anything about unmarried women's sex drives, right? All right, so finally, the third myth or falsehood or lie that I think we tell in the church that I just want to hold up. And this, I think we hear a lot from the pulpit. I've heard it from the pulpit. Is the idea that if you've had premarital sex or you've somehow engaged in sexual sin, this is the unforgivable sin and there's no undoing it. You're just stuck. And as I said, I read a million Christian articles and books about this, and because I'm sort of a nerdy bookworm, I began to keep track of the metaphors that people used when describing sexual sin. And the two most powerful metaphors for the consequences of premarital sex were scars and ghosts. That is, if you've had premarital sex, you are scarred forever. Full stop, next topic. Or if you've had premarital sex and you managed to fool some poor guy into marrying you anyway, then the ghosts of your ex-boyfriends will be like hovering around your marriage bed forever. So what I think people are trying to get at, to sort of offer the charitable read when they give this sort of scar and ghost language, I didn't realize actually that Christians believed in ghosts, but I myself have always wanted to live in a haunted house, so I'm excited to know that there might be theological room for that. What I think people are trying to get at is the idea that what we do has consequences. There is no way of going through a day in this life neutrally. We are formed by the quotidian acts that make up our days. We are formed and shaped by them. And that every day on this planet presents opportunities to grow closer to God and to become more radically new creatures. And that the days of our lives present opportunities to do things that do the opposite of that and harden the effects of the fall in our heart and estrange us from God and our neighbors. And then I think particularly, though I wouldn't want to say that sexual sin is unique or the worst kind of sin, I do think that the embodied actions we do may be particularly formative. Not just the sexual ones, but that learning that we do in our body, kinetic learning, is pretty powerful. And I think embodied formation sticks with us in particularly powerful ways. But saying all that is not the same thing as saying, you're scarred forever, right? And just to speak autobiographically, I've now been married for like 3.5 years, and something about my past. My husband, when we met, he wasn't my husband yet, my now husband when we met was not only a 27-year-old virgin, who somehow doesn't mind my going around the country and saying that. He was a little uncomfortable when I told it to Diane Sawyer, but other than that, he's been pretty cool with it. He had kissed one person once, and it had been 7 years. So although we were on the same page with our commitments not to have sex with each other until we got married, we were like approaching that with somewhat different, narratives in this area. And when we did get married, I thought, actually, that because I had recognized this sinfulness in my own life years before, and because I had really pretty radically turned from it and repented of it and hadn't had sex for a number of years, I just thought I was, like, totally done and would just be ecstatic about having sex, and that I would really not be affected in my marital sex life at all by the experiences I'd had before. And I actually sort of worried that Griff, what occurred to me when we were engaged, that he'd never actually seen a real woman's body, and all of his images of women's bodies were airbrushed. So I got very nervous about that. And then I also thought, well, he's been, you know, repressing his desire for so many years. I thought it might take him, like, a year or two to get over kind of, like, guilt, anxiety about sex, to really enjoy it. This was not a concern I needed to have. He was just right there ready to go. And I had also misjudged my own situation. I hadn't just misjudged his. I think I am still unlearning the really false lessons and pretty destructive lessons that I learned about sex from those years of fornication. Now, fornication's not a pretty word, but I don't think it's a pretty sin. So I use that word to describe my sexual behavior before. And in particular, what I learned from those years of premarital sex was to associate what was erotic and exciting about sex with the sort of constant newness and kind of fundamental instability of dating sex. It seems to me that even in the most long-term, stable, in scare quotes, dating relationship, there's a fundamental quality of instability. And there's a fundamental question about, am I going to be here next week? Am I going to be here in the morning? Am I not? And that quality, instability is sort of a negative word, so let's call it possibility, a less negative word. That quality drives part of what is exciting or seemingly thrilling or what have you about extramarital sex. And I exposed myself to that enough to where that was the equation in my head. What makes sex exciting is the fundamental uncertainty of the situation. So, you know, marital sex then is quite different from premarital sex in that way, right? Because marital sex, whatever else it may or may not be, hopefully you're not, like, wondering if you're going to be there the next day. So there's a fundamental quality of stability and of certainty, right, to marital sexuality. And I think I am still, to an extent, having to unlearn this association between instability and sexiness, and really having to learn a whole new grammar of what makes good sex good. We can talk about this more if people are interested. I do really think that the world tells us that good sex, whether or not you're married, is the sex that is as much like dating sex as possible. And that if you're married, what you're supposed to do to, like, ramp up your sex life is try to make it as much like your dating sex life as you can. So, I think what people are trying to get at with the scar and ghost language is some real awareness and recognition of the real formation that happens when one engages in fornication, when one uses internet porn, etc. But to say that we teach ourselves lessons through those encounters, and that those lessons may take a very long time to unlearn, is not the same thing as saying one is scarred forever, right, if one has engaged in sexual sin. The problem with saying that one is scarred forever is that it's fundamentally contrary to the basic message of the gospel, which is one of forgiveness, and one of Jesus's bright red blood being more powerful than any red letter sin that we might commit. I think that we are, frankly, in the church, when it comes to matters of sexuality, really scared to teach and preach forgiveness. I think we fear, particularly when it comes to our kids, our literally and communally. I think we fear that if we talk about forgiveness, we're giving people permission to do something they don't want to do. But I just want to suggest that I think that God's promises are bigger than that and are bigger than our fears, and that when we preach forgiveness, we're not giving license, we're giving people the gospel. And that is part of what I mean when I say I hope that we can reconnect our teachings about sexuality to our more basic Christian teachings. Well, I was going to talk a little bit about things I wish I'd done in the book that I didn't do, but it's 5 o'clock. So I think that I will save that. If people are interested, they can ask. But let me stop and invite your questions. And Tim's going to run around with this mic. I'm really hard of hearing, so please actually speak into the mic. And do you have a question you want to start with? Or
it's about that part of the book that you wish you would have written had you had it to do over again.
Really?
Seriously, right?
Okay.
Yeah, good.
Well, there are probably a lot of things I might do somewhat differently, but I really wish that I'd written a whole chapter. I mean, I wrote not at all, but I wish I'd written a whole chapter about sexual violence, which is not mentioned in the book. And as I have, and frankly, it just didn't occur to me. It's not like I thought about writing that chapter and decided against it. It just wasn't in my kind of imagined universe of what this book was supposed to be about. But particularly as I've spoken at some colleges on this topic since finishing the book, I have not gone to a single college where at least one person, sometimes more, and usually a woman, but not always a woman, comes up to me afterwards to talk about being raped. And particularly disturbing is when I am at a Christian college and the discourse is almost always about the person's sins, that they, the rape victim, have sinned and that they've fallen and that they're not pure, you know, that they're to blame for this, as if they had consensually made a choice of having premarital sex. And I feel that the church is really silent about sexual violence, and that I, to some extent, have been complicit in that, unintentionally, but nonetheless complicit in that by writing this whole book about this topic and not discussing that question. And it's, to me, it sort of has become like the white SUV. You know, someone talks to you about a white SUV, and then you see them all over town. Like, once I got kind of a little more sensitized to that, I have become more aware of just how pervasive sexual violence is in our communities, and how churches just don't talk about it. And when they do talk about it, they seem to talk about it in ways that suggest that they don't actually care about women and children, as far as I'm concerned. So that's one thing that I would do differently.
If you want to ask a question, go ahead and stick your hand up, and then I'll just walk to wherever you are and give you a chance to do so. Oh.
How would you address the issue of chastity any differently to non-believers, as opposed, you seem to be pointing this book towards Christians?
Well, that's interesting, because I'm not sure that I would address it to not. Did everyone hear the question? Chastity and non-believers. To me, the issue of chastity is an issue of obedience to Jesus. And one can offer lots of pragmatic arguments also, and those might have to do with pregnancy or STDs or procreation, all sorts of pragmatic arguments that may, in fact, be true, but ultimately, in my view, don't quite get at the heart of things. And I said earlier, like, the statement premarital sex is wrong. If I were asked that by a pollster, I'm not sure what I would say, because one can make a kind of theological natural law argument, certainly, that it is God's will for everyone to only have sex within marriage, and that that's part of the created order. And I think that's a real plausible argument. But on the other hand, to me, it's just inexplicably a piece of Christian discipleship, and one that in our culture in particular would seem impossible to actually maintain for any length of time without actually a community of discipleship and the active presence of the Holy Spirit. Now, one can imagine that the Holy Spirit might be present in the life of an unbeliever. The community of discipleship piece, it's hard to imagine that being real present in the life of an unbeliever. So in my life, I actually haven't really discussed it much with non-believers. And part of that is an intentional choice, because I think in Christian discourses about this, we spend so much time in the generalizable pragmatic, the STD, what have you. Practically, you know, three of my absolute best friends are completely irreligious, and two of them are very anti-religious. And one of those two is a divorced woman in her 40s who, among other things, really likes to have sex. And, you know, I don't view it as my job to, like, witness to her about this. And I've never actually, I mean, she knew I was writing this book and blah, blah. And the only time we've ever talked about it was when Griff and I were engaged, and my friend said to me, "So you're really still not having sex with him? What's up with that?" And then I felt like, well, with that invitation, I wasn't trying to convert her to Christian sexual ethics. I was trying to tell her about something in my own life. And I'm much more concerned about her relationship with God than I am about whether she's having sex with someone. To me, chastity is secondary. It's an important secondary, but it's, you know, it's an epiphenomenon, if you will, of the much more basic fundamental question of what is someone's relationship with God. So I do think, of course, there are situations where one might have a friend who is not a Christian, who's doing something so damaging and so destructive sexually that it does become an urgent issue. But perhaps this is like Pollyanna piety. I also trust that if that's the situation, then the Holy Spirit will give you some sense of what you're supposed to say. But in general, I mean, you know, like the cultured despisers of religion, one of the things they say about us Christians is, these are the people who are obsessed with regulating everyone's sexual behavior. Well, they're sort of right about that. I mean, certainly in our public presentation to the world, we do seem pretty obsessed with that. And to me, that's actually not a great witness. In a sense, I'm glad I wrote this book. I get mail occasionally that suggests it's been meaningful to people. But in a certain sense, I almost feel like, well, even in writing on this topic, I've just furthered that thought that Christians are obsessed with sex. To me, this is not the only important issue of faithful living, and I'm not even sure I would say it's the most important issue. It seems to me that it is one of a constellation of important pieces of the life of discipleship that, from my vantage, don't actually make true sense outside of that framework of discipleship. So that may be a complete non-answer to your question, but I don't have an answer to your question. Tim, do you have something to say about that?
No. No, I don't.
Somehow I think that's not normal that he doesn't have things to say, right?
You haven't mentioned that you have kids, so I'm assuming you don't. But I have a 2-year-old who may or may not have seen a MTV music video of, say, Rihanna. And I wondered, I don't know if you've seen it.
Did you say a 2-year-old?
Yes. Yeah. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on, like, my 2-year-old seeing a music video. You can imagine what might be in it. How that shapes him, or does it have more to do with my attitude or my husband's attitude toward sex and beauty? I hope you understand that question.
Well, that's a great question. I have to say that it's, like, really easy for me to talk about parenting since I don't have children. And I'm sure that if I ever do have children, everything I've said on this topic with a microphone in my hand will come back to, you know, bite me in the tuchus. I'll answer that in two parts. So at risk of getting, like, burned in effigy when I leave Kansas City, I'm really pretty anti-TV. And I have not had a TV for 13 years, and at first that was like just because I didn't have one, and it's actually, I've actually become really sort of zealous about it and quite evangelistic. And I will say that I constantly straddle in my own life and mind, on the one hand, not wanting to posit some too much of a break between church and world, and I don't want to posit too much of an opposition between those two things. On the other hand, it would seem willfully naive to me to not envision, you know, we do live in a fallen world and a broken world, and so how does one negotiate that? And negotiating it involves sometimes thinking of some oppositions between church and world. And I know there's like really good TV out there, but I think a lot of it's sludge, and that because I'm constantly thinking about formation, I really worry about the kind of formation that all of us get from television, which I think, among other things, is our most passive medium. So I do have a computer in my house, but a computer's not quite as passive, right? And I will just say to parents that I just read an amazing, amazing, amazing book called The Big Turnoff, which is the memoir and account of a woman who did not let her who loved TV, was TV obsessed, and did not let her child watch TV ever for 6 years. And it's a really interesting account, among other things, of how much criticism she got for that. So I'll just put that out there as possible reading material. So I do worry about kids and television and the kind of formation that kids get and that we get. That said, I don't think that means that everyone has to leave here and throw their televisions out. But that I think when we have any of those kind of media in our homes, magazine, computer stuff, television, which all of us do, it seems crucial to me for parents to just be constantly, not obsessively, but regularly in conversation. Now, I don't know how you do that with a two-year-old because I'm not a developmental psychologist. But in general, I think the whole trend towards like quality time with your kids is bogus. And that there's a lot to be said for quantity time with our families. I would say the same thing about marriage, that like you can't fix a marriage in which you don't ever spend any time with a person by going on a date once a week. Like that quantity and ordinary conversations and ordinary life together about how to be in the world goes a huge way toward contextualizing something like an MTV video. So I also, and here I sort of often tick off some of my Catholic friends, because I'm sort of obsessed with this principle of formation, I also, that lands me in a place where I don't really think that, like, one MTV video is going to kill anyone. I don't think that one exposure to pornography, I don't think it's good to have that one exposure to pornography, but to me, the questions are questions of habituation. Those are, to me, the most important questions. So I suppose I wouldn't vote, if I had a vote in this decision, for a regular diet of MTV video for any of us, probably, but two-year-olds. But it does seem to me if that can just be refined, and part of it seems to me what we're modeling for kids, and here I do say we, because I don't think this is just a job for parents. I think it's a job for everyone in the church who is and should be and ought to be in relationships with kids, whether or not they're your kids or not. Part of what we're modeling is how to engage in culture. So I'm not suggesting that what we model is totally avoiding culture, right? But that we model pretty actively for our kids, like, both judicious discretion about engagement with culture and also kind of creative conflict and openness. I do find it peculiar that when Christians start thinking about, for ourselves or our children, how do we make decisions about, like, what movie we can go see or what have you, I find, and obviously those conversations tend to happen more in pretty conservative corners of evangelicalism. I know those labels are of limited utility, but I find the criteria that get used peculiar. Like, the amount of skin shown seems to me not data. Maybe at a particular stage in developmental psychology it actually might be data, but for adults, the data is, what's the story? I mean, you can have a movie with an awful lot of fornication in it. The question is, what's the narrative there? Is the narrative about exposing some of the destructiveness of that, or is the narrative about kind of idolizing it and pretending that it's beautiful? it seems to me that if we're going to sort of censor our own encounters with media, that we ought to be asking sort of narrative questions, at least for adults. Again, I don't have expertise vis-a-vis kids, rather than kind of skin tone, skin content, word, you know, cursing, etc.
It comes like sexual desires. There's one distinction that I kind of struggle with, and that's, you know, if God created our bodies and what he made is good and he created these sexual desires and that too is good, then where does the word lust fit into that? And like, what's the difference between these sexual desires and then lust?
Great question. When I was first working on this book, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine in D.C. where I said, you know, I really want to explore, like, really, I don't know what Jesus means by lust. And and my friend looked at me and he said, yeah, you do. You do know what he means. Nonetheless, I do think it's a good question. I guess I tend to speak of desire that is rightly ordered and desire that is not rightly ordered or that is wrongly ordered. And lust, it seems to me, is one iteration or one kind of wrongly ordered sexual desire. I understand lust as being about the stance of wanting to consume someone and wanting to devour someone for one's own purposes, which may, of course, mean that it's not just sexual. You probably could have that lust about a colleague, or, you know, that isn't a sexual expression. There's a desert father story, and I am going to draw a complete blank on which desert father this is, but it was someone, I think, in Alexandria, who was this well-known preacher, and he came to town to give this sermon, and the local prostitute who hated Christianity wanted to trip him up, basically. And so in the middle, and she was totally beautiful, and in the middle of the sermon, she came, like, marching into the church and marching down the aisle and, like, did this striptease and took off all her clothes. And the desert father began to weep, and someone asked him why he was weeping, and he said he was weeping for her beauty and for the fallenness of the world. And it seems to me that that's a pretty good picture of being able to appreciate, who knows if he was experiencing sexual desire, right? But being able to appreciate erotic beauty in a way that is the exact opposite of wanting to consume it. I think the focus on consuming also means that, you know, you can have lust for your spouse, and I don't think Jesus is too excited about that kind of lust either. I think in the sort of more down-to-earth context of, like, an unmarried person or a married person who's experiencing sexual desire for someone else other than their spouse, it seems to me like the erotic is always in play. That's part of who we are, and that's part of our culture. And to deny that the erotic is in play seems not helpful. But thinking about why the erotic is in play in a particular situation and what the faithful response to that is. So it doesn't freak me out that sometimes I have erotically charged feelings about someone who's not my husband. The question is, what do I do then? Right? And if I fixate or feed them, then that seems to me to be the path of lustfulness and also probably the path of adultery. If I sort of recognize it and, like, ask God to help me appreciate the person in his or her beauty in all kinds of ways and hope that that feeling sort of passes through, to me, that's not I can't judge that as something that Jesus is up in heaven weeping about. But I'm sure people may differ on that.
When I was 18, I was an art student, and I went to KU, and one of the things that happened when I was an early art student was a person walked into a room and they took off their clothes and I had to draw them. And that was challenging to be an 18-year-old guy and have somebody walk in, as you might imagine, and do that. And yet, over the course of 2 years, what I began to discover was I had very few categories for a human being unclothed that didn't make them into an object. And I think one of the things that was very beneficial for me in that time was beginning to learn how to appreciate another human being without clothes, without objectifying them. And I think that somehow speaks into that idea of lust as well, because I think that there's a robbing of identity in lust that, you know what I mean, that takes away their personhood, that I think is really dangerous. And I think that one of the things that we struggle with, and you talk about this a lot in your book, and maybe you can speak on it for a second, Lauren, is what does it mean to live in bodies, and particularly bodies that are that have sexuality but that aren't merely sexual, and how we, I think as a culture, I think it's why pornography is so pervasive and everything, because we don't have a way of engaging bodies that's not eroticized, that's not objectified. And you talk about that a great deal in your body. I think for a lot of us who sit in front of computers all day and then never engage our bodies, I think
porn is not only that we live in this sort of culture that teaches us this weird distorted form of erotic behavior, but it's actually how an evidence of how disembodied our culture is. I mean, I will admit, I think I like intuitively get a lot of aspects of sexual sin. I don't totally get porn. I don't get it. Because what I can't quite imaginatively get beyond when I think about porn is, like, it's not a person. It is not another person. It might not even be a picture of another person. It could just be pixels. So there's something... porn bespeaks something also, I think, about actually a radical discomfort with not only dealing with another person's emotions and needs and desires, but actually another person's flesh. Equally, I mean, I think one could sort of throw into the mix here questions about standards of beauty and you know, our culture, our surrounding culture and our church culture sort of says, you know, it's normal to want to have sex. It's normal to be having sex. It's abnormal not to have sex or not to desire sex. But it also says that only a pretty small range of people get to count in, like, who gets to count as sexy. So if someone's overweight or old or disabled or whatever, they are culturally cut off from this way of being in the world that our culture is saying is kind of essential. And I think the church hasn't held up any different kind of models of beauty. We just absorb and reflect the kind of larger culture's word on that.
Hand it to you.
Earlier you were saying about premarital sex then being talked about as impure. And if you say yourself for marriage, you're talked about as being pure. And like you said, we'll talk about that another day. But could today be the other day?
That day is now. I find the word pure to be a really complicated one. I don't think it's an inherently bad word. I do think it gets used so weirdly in kind of evangelical speak that I tend to stay away from it. And I think the weird ways it gets used are, A, it gets used in this kind of discourse that feeds into what I call virginity righteousness. The idea that your entire sexual ethics boils down to this switch of being a virgin, if you're not married, I mean. And so you can be on, like, one side of that and be pure and then, like, inch over here and not be suddenly, which to me is just a useless, bogus, and unhelpful way of thinking about sexual faithfulness and discipleship in this arena. And partially that's because it seems important to note that, A, none of us is without sin and brokenness in the area of sexuality. I mean, by Jesus' standard of lust in your heart, no one is pure, right? Except arguably Mother Teresa. There was that controversy a few years ago about Mother Teresa and lust. See, you're having trouble thinking of Mother Teresa as a sexual person, aren't you? Because she was old and shriveled, right? Illustrating my other point. But I think not only is the issue that, like, all of us have brokenness in this area of our lives, but also no, the world, redemption is not complete. So none of us is pure. I mean, even for setting aside sex, right? So I have a pretty high theology of baptism. Baptism occupies a very significant, I view baptism not just as an initiation rite, but because it's an initiation rite into the body of Christ, I view it as a moment of real ontological change. I have a very high view of it theologically. Somehow we have to be able to say one is washed clean and pure in the waters of baptism, and then one lives in and has one's being in a world that is not yet redeemed fully. And so I just get very, I think so. So then the final reason that I get nervous about the language of purity is I think in our current evangelical culture, it carries with it the assumption that really what you're supposed to do with a Christian as a Christian is hang out with other pure people. And that seems to me to be exactly wrong. That we don't go to the baptismal font and get made pure there in order to hang out with other people who are clean. We do that so that we are graced in a particular way to go hang with the unwashed. And we don't come to the Eucharist table in order to stay there at a dinner party full of other Eucharist people. We do that so that we can be a Eucharist in a broken world. And I just think in its current usage, the way that purity gets bandied about carries with it connotations of self-righteousness and of a kind of impermeable Christian community where pure people are supposed to stay pure by hanging out with other pure people. And I think that that's not true.
I had a question about you made a comment in your book regarding clothing and worship. Can you clarify that a little more? Because I've, at Jacob's Well in particular, we wear shorts and, it's summertime.
Oh, the formality thing?
The formality thing.
Yeah. It's like, what did I say?
Will you frame it, though?
Yes.
Will you frame your argument and why you made that argument? I guess I just totally don't understand.
Yes, I knew that people would completely disagree with that in a lot of churches. You have to remember I am an Episcopalian. We don't have much going for us, but we do dress well in church. So the point I make in the book in this brief discussion of clothing is I suggest that there might be better ways to dress for Sunday corporate worship and less good ways and that the formal way of dressing might have something to say for itself, as opposed to the flip-flop way of dressing for Sunday worship. Now, I was being somewhat intentionally provocative in the book in saying that. Would I really say it's just absolutely in all circumstances better to, like, wear a tuxedo to church instead of flip-flops? No. I think I do say this in the book, that it was a really important thing that happened in the 1960s in this country, that church for white people stopped just being about, like, going and showing off your best clothing, and that anyone was invited to come in, even if they had the lamest and most ratty clothing. That said, the point I was trying to make was, again, formational, and was just an invitation to think about the ways that our clothing shape us. And we know that clothing shapes us, or else we wouldn't enjoy fashion so much, right? I mean, fashion is a verb before it's a noun, right? So clothing fashions who we are and who we present ourselves as being and how we act. So I think I also say in the book, I mean, another example of this would be I teach at a university, and it really ticks me off when my students show up dressed for the gym, because that tells me what their priorities are. Their real important event that day is going to the gym. And, when you're in a classroom where everyone is wearing gym clothes, there's a kind of casual informality that I think is not the best posture for classroom learning, nor would I say the best posture is like the absolute most formal clothing that would make everyone uptight and formal. So all that to say, I do think something it may be that everyone in here disagrees with me, and I think that's fine. I do not think this is a matter of creedal orthodoxy. I do think something is lost in our register of worship experiences when communal worship is always done in informal clothing. Because I think that is inviting us into one particular kind of worship experience. Similarly, I think something would be lost if someone's corporate worship always happened in the most formal of clothing. But I do think that clothing signals to ourselves and to others something about what's happening. And part of what informal clothing signals is a real emphasis on intimacy. I think that's fabulous, but that's only one way of being with God. And another way of being with God is reverencing a transcendent king. And I will autobiographically say a huge part of my thinking about this comes from Judaism. I mean, we're in the Jewish communities in which I grew up, even you did put on your Sunday best for Friday night services, right? I mean, you dressed to the nines because you were going to have an audience with a king. Now, we could also say, well, Judaism is the Jewish imagination of God places almost total emphasis on a transcendent kingly God. That's a really important image of God in Jewish liturgy. And I would say that's just one piece of God. But I miss in my Christian life, in my kind of life in American evangelicalism, as much as I appreciate the intimacy that Jesus is my friend and Jesus is my lover and all that kind of intimacy, I think as a community we don't do well the God as transcendent, God as royal, God as judge. And I think clothing is part of that. So I think one should worship God in all sorts of kinds of clothes, but we should not be thoughtless or naive about why it matters to us and why churches actually have real arguments about this. We're not just arguing about social codes, although that was part of what we were arguing about in the 60s. We're also arguing about kind of what is the tenor of the experience that we're wanting to have, and I think we have room in a Christian vocabulary for lots of different kinds of experiences, and that we limit ourselves when we sort of get stuck in one way of conceiving of our relationship with God. I mean, frankly, I think that de facto, most American Christians are functional Unitarians, which is to say that we may profess a Trinitarian faith, but functionally, most communities devote much more kind of energy and give much more time to one of the three persons of God. And evangelicals tend to like do the Jesus intimate thing and not kind of live with those other two persons of the Trinity as much. All that from flip-flops.
What a great conversation. This is great. Let me ask you a quick thing to comment on. One of the things that I think comes out loud and clear in the book, Lauren, is this idea of community and how a community shapes sexuality, among many other things. And yet in our book club discussion, whenever that would come up, it seemed like we had a fairly thin imagination as to what that might look like beyond accountability. So the only way I'm going to share this with people is if people tell me how not to do the thing that I really want to do, right? And so I'm putting this impetus on you to hold me accountable. Can you maybe just reflect briefly on some of the ways that you think community positively can influence or allow for expression of sexuality? I don't mean doing it. I mean like what it looks like to be sexual beings in community where it's not merely about not doing something.
Yeah, I actually think we ought to table the word accountability for about 25 years because it's not an inherently bad thing. It's actually an inherently Pauline thing, but I think in Paul's vision, it was a step that would always be necessary in a fallen world, but was necessary as a last measure. And hopefully through individual and communal lives of ongoing Christian formation might become necessary less and less often, though will probably always be necessary this side of eternity. So it seems to me that in a kind of Pauline idiom of community, and if you're here tomorrow, you'll hear some more of this. In a Pauline idiom community, we are called to be a community of storytellers, where through word and action, and that is both formal sacramental action, but also much more ordinary action, we are telling one another over and over what the Christian story is, who we are in Christ, and why we do what we do. And it seems to me that if that were our fundamental view of community, and we see that accountability then is like a kind of peripheral, when that fails, as it inevitably sometimes will fail, then we police the boundaries. Communities do have to police their boundaries. So sexually, what does that mean? I should clarify that I don't think that sex doesn't have a private dimension. I mean, sex is an intimate thing that does have a dimension that is private. But in the Christian grammar, I don't think there's anything that only has a private dimension. That doesn't mean that the church is fascism, you know, far from it. I think freedom in Christ is far more than just a catchphrase. But there is an unavoidably public communal component, in part because we think that sex matters, right? I mean, if sex were the equivalent of brushing your teeth formationally, then it wouldn't actually have such a kind of communal urgency. But because we believe that sex, like education and like art and like prayer and like how we spend money, forms us into the people we are, then it's a matter of Christian conviction. So in my own life, I can point to a couple of ways very practically that sex has been communal. Some of them do have to do with boundaries. I mean, I tell the story in the book of when Griff and I were dating and we were trying to decide, like, how to do this well. And we went to have these conversations with this friend of ours who's a little bit older and who happened to be a pastor, though he wasn't our pastor. And he gave us this, like, guideline about what to do and, you know, the kind of line-drawing conversation. I tell that story in the book for a reason. Not because I think everyone who's dating needs to, like, draw the same line that Griff and I drew, but because I do think that anyone who is in a dating relationship ought to be talking with your date person, with some third person about how you're handling, no pun intended, the issue of sexual faithfulness and dating. Yeah, I think we are just totally prone to self-deception all the time in all areas of our life, but we are really prone to self-deception when it comes to sex and money. And if you want to see yourself deceiving yourself, like, go hang out with your girlfriend at 2 a.m. on a couch in a dark room, and you will see yourself begin to be deceptive about what you ought to be doing. So in that instance, making our sexual choices really quite communal, we ask this third person to kind of represent the rule of Christ and the mind of Christ in our intimate decisions. You know, it's like embarrassing. I would think, like, what am I, 14? I mean, I cannot believe I'm having these conversations with this person. That said, a second way in which sex has proved to be a communal issue in my life has been that when we got married and we had a very rough first year of marriage for a lot of reasons, but including sexually, I was so grateful that we had already sort of gotten comfortable talking to someone else about this, because in my experience, I mean, my husband and I have, like, very good communication, and there's not much we don't tell each other, and I'm pretty frank, as you can tell, and he's fairly frank, too, and there has been nothing harder to talk with him about than the places where I feel like I am failing sexually. There are conversations in which I feel ashamed. They are just really hard conversations to have. And so the ability to have someone else, and I don't mean therapy, though that sometimes, you know, I don't mean a formal pastoral or therapeutic conversation, but just to have people in your life that you can really have speaking into this, that's not about accountability. That's about, like, helping you hear yourself and helping you think about what's truthful, and so that's been a key thing in my life. And then finally, I conclude the book, or near the end of the book, I tell this story about my friend M, not his real name, who calls me up and asks me, you know, why he shouldn't go sleep with someone he's not married to, and I just sort of ask him not to as personal favor, you know, not to like go over there Friday night to her house. So again, that's accountability of a sort, I suppose. I tell the story of that in the book, not because I thought it was like an endlessly sustainable strategy to get this guy to be chaste as a personal favor for 15 years. I didn't think that would really work. But rather because I realized in that conversation that was actually not the beginning of community with this guy. That was like the middle of it. And the reason I was able to even have a conversation about anything that mattered with this person was because we'd been friends for years and had a very deep but ordinary relationship with one another, consisting of going to the grocery store together. You know, he could come to my house and do laundry because he didn't have a washing machine, and he could just walk in and do that. And I would call him if my car broke. I mean, just ordinary life together. And it seems to me that, again, part of the fallacy of the culture of the small group, and small groups can be fantastic, but part of the fallacy is, well, you get into a small group with someone for 3 weeks, and then you should have, like, soul bearing with that person. I remember in college, my last year in college, I broke up with a guy I've been dating for like 3.5 years, and I was totally devastated and weeping and miserable. And my aunt happened to be coming to visit. And I was in college in New York, and she got out of the cab, and she was not into my apartment building before she said, "So how are you doing about John Doe, and my boyfriend?" And I said, "Actually, I'm totally miserable and weeping all the time." And she said, "Well, you're not going to kill yourself, are you?" And I thought, like, what are you talking about? And I've realized in hindsight, this is actually my aunt's strategy. For, like, you know, I saw her once a year. She loved me and wanted to be close to me. And so she asked me, like, the most laser-like intimate question she could think of. You know, and that doesn't make up for not having seen someone for a year, right? And so part of, I think, the community question is simply time logged with people in a place doing stuff together. And this, maybe this doesn't have very much to do, obviously, with sex, but I think it's hard to do that when we live in a culture where Americans move every 7 years. It's hard to do that as young, upwardly mobile people. Upwardly mobile means away from something, among other things. It's hard to do that in a culture where, you know, we're rewarded for traveling with frequent flyer miles, and like that's a good thing to be a frequent flyer, right? So if one is moving physically a lot, it's hard, I think, I actually think it's impossible to have the kind of relationship, maybe not impossible, with God all things are possible. I think it's really hard to have the kinds of relationships with people or with locations where things that matter can unfold. In part because we meet people in our lives who know us well for a long time and can tell us stories not just about Christ but about ourselves and how we've been doing the same thing over and over again or how we've changed. And that has a lot to do with sex. Again, I would say that sex is just one area where community life, sort of the rubber hits the road. A friend of mine told me recently, and I was horrified, that he and his wife had decided that they would function financially as though they were a nonprofit with a board in the following way. That at the end of every year, they would tally up all of their income, all of their expenditures, and all of their charitable giving, and they would give a copy of that to their pastor, their close friends from church, and also to everyone who received charitable giving from them, including like the guy on the corner. And then they would be open to statements of blessing and rebuke about that. And I just completely freaked out because, I mean, if you don't want your sex life shattered from the rooftop, I mean, I don't think any of us want our credit card debt shattered from the rooftop, right? Talk about shame. And I was so convinced, I was like, well, that's what I ought to be doing. I haven't actually made any movement toward doing that yet because it's so horrifying to me. it seems to me that if the church had fewer accountability groups and more blessing groups, we would find ourselves eventually in a much different place. Like the point of these relationships and conversations and life together is not so that you have a bunch of people who can pronounce accountability to you. The point is so that you can have people who can pronounce God's blessing to you. And occasionally, they probably have to do some policing. I think we're all starving for it. I mean, we know often when we're screwing up. I think we don't hear a lot statements of God's blessing to us, and I think it's a shame.
This may be a fantastic failure of a question, but you mentioned the idea of lust being in conjunction with consumption. And I'm curious, I haven't read the book, so maybe you addressed this at
You're
length.
Absolved.
Bless you.
It seems to me that in the world of imagination or fantasy, that a number of forces begin to be at play, like fear, anger, and these kind of things, and that they're the catalysts for cyclical thinking that would maybe be lustful. And I'm just curious what you think of how you would define Christian sexual fantasy / imagination, probably making a distinction between the two. But
can you ask this a little less abstractly, because I'm not sure I'm totally tracking with your question.
I was just hoping you'd sort of sound off on it for a while, that was all.
Tim, restate that question.
All right,
I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just want to make
no,
sure.
No, that's fine. I mean, I think in the context of healthy Christian sexual thinking,
right.
Okay, to what degree do you feel fantasy and or imagination play a role, both premaritally, maritally, mm-hmm. and then, I guess, extramaritally? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question to which I don't. I mean, I'll just ramble. I don't know that I have a great answer for it. Somehow, the word imagination strikes me very differently than the word fantasy. So why is that? I suppose somehow in this context, fantasy strikes me as the thing that's just unmoored from reality. And I don't think that I can immediately think of a situation where that seems fruitful. Imagination seems like the heart of the matter, though, because part of what we're about, part of what we're about entirely, setting aside just the question of sex, is we're a community of people trying to cultivate the mind of Christ. We're trying to have the mind of Christ. That's what Paul tells the Corinthians, and it remains true. And Paul tells the Corinthians that we actually do have the mind of Christ, far weirder when you think about the church at Corinth. Right? This fractious, lustful, like, they have the mind of Christ. So do we, and we are supposed to be cultivating that. So it seems to me that what we're about is reimagining the world, and that part of a challenge, I think, for Protestants in North America is that evangelical Protestantism, we actually don't live in a very richly populated, imagined world. We don't really live in a sacred universe. Like the Orthodox Jews, they live in a sacred universe. The Mormons, sacred universe. Some Catholics and Eastern Orthodox, we basically live in like thin consumer capitalism and occasional church going. That's basically, and I think that's not a good thing. So vis-a-vis sex, I just don't have a good answer to this. I mean, I guess my knee-jerk thought is, at least maritally, yes, I think some imagining is appropriate and good. And I guess here's again my opposition between church and world. My question would be like, well, where are the pictures coming from? Which is to say, are we imagining something that is in essence based on a universe of advertisements? Or are we imagining something that is in essence based on the Song of Songs? Now, I suppose discerning the difference between those may not always be straightforward. I will say, here I get a little like evangelical fence building sounding. it does seem to me that we live in a culture that so saturates us with bad sexual images that when you're talking about non-marital sexual imagining, in general, I would say, like, here let me err on the side of fundamentalism. Because it seems so unlikely to me that in our culture the pictures and the motives are coming from a great place. But I'm going to ask Tim to comment on this because I don't feel like I've actually said anything that I feel confident about. Go ahead, Tim.
No comment.
You have a question?
I have a question, I think.
No?
Well, I want to...
You have a comment on that?
Well, I was wondering, I don't know if I can, you know how your brain works, and I can't form it into a question that quickly.
Okay.
So let me come back to me.
Okay. Can we all sit here for a minute? I want to think about... Well, actually, let's let somebody else ask a question, then I can think about it and see if I want to find... Wow, we got some questions, and we've got about 15 minutes, so this is perfect. I think we can...
As I was kind of reading the book and thinking about chastity, it seems like the idea of waiting until marriage in the biblical sense and like the Old Testament kind of objectified women as they were supposed to be like the pure vessels, but men had multiple wives and, you know, like the idea of the virgin bride was really like held up. How do you reconcile like that idea of like objectifying women with the gospel when in context of waiting till marriage?
Great question. And this is actually something also that I wish I'd written more about in the book and regret not writing more about. I do think that it is virtually impossible, to talk about the Christian tradition of thinking about the question of chastity and not run pretty quickly into both Gnosticism, that is the church always being dogged by this heresy of hating the material and kind of dichotomizing the material and the spiritual, and running into really deep-seated misogyny. You don't have to scrape too far beneath the surface to get there. Now, at the same time, and this is what I wish I'd written about in the book, there is in our Christian tradition actually quite radical non-misogyny on this question of chastity and celibacy. And I would highly recommend a book by the historian Peter Brown called, I think it's called Men, Women, and the Body, Sexual Renunciation in the Early Church. And it's a book, it's kind of dense historical study, about 25 years old, but that argues, among other things, quite persuasively, I think, that in the early church, in the context of Imperial Rome, I mean, the Old Testament and the New Testament communities were not the only ones that had problems with women, right? And that part of what women were expected to do in the imperial context was to just to produce new citizens of the state, right? That was their purpose. And so that actually the sexual renunciation for women in the early church was quite a radical rejection of this view, A, that you're a citizen of the empire and not a citizen of the kingdom of God, and B, that your body is defined and your role in life is defined by your sexual and bodily service of the ends of that empire. And that in that emphasis on chastity was a radical statement for all imperial citizens, but in particular for women, about where their worth came from. So I think our history has some parts that to me seem good and some parts that don't seem so good. That said, I mean, I think the fact that biblical teaching gets distorted all the time throughout church history, and not just biblical teaching about women, but biblical teaching about lots of things, does not mean that the teaching or the Bible is ought to be tossed out. It does mean that I think we have to constantly ask ourselves as a community where in our generation our kind of cultural imperialism is coming from. Because I don't think there has been a generation in church history that has not allowed itself and the radical message of Jesus Christ to be held captive by some other ideologies. Now, I will say, I think in our contemporary setting, there remains absolutely a double standard. I mean, I don't think there's any question that on the ground, and this stuff about women not having sex drives and men having sex drives is just the tip of the iceberg, there remains a huge double standard about sex, about whether it's legitimate to remain single, much more legitimate for men to remain single in our church culture. I mean, first of all, there aren't that many men. But much more legitimate for the men to remain single than for the women. I mean, the fact that you can go to respectable Christian website, web magazine sites, and find articles suggesting that Christian women are being unfaithful when, as single women, they buy houses, because that indicates that they're, like, not just waiting around to get married, and that they might be signaling too much independence to any man who might come along. I think it's just appalling to me. So it seems to me that we do have to be cognizant of the way the gender stuff is inflected and plays out in our own time and place. But I think that's a great and really important question.
Comment too about my no comment comment to Don's question was not a statement about his question. It was about my inability to reflect on it in time to give it the kind of dignified answer it deserved.
We all knew that.
Okay.
But thanks for clarifying.
Just wanted to clarify that.
First of all, Lauren, I just want to comment on one of your chapters, chapter 8, about singleness and what it teaches to the church. And I thought it was very good. It was right on the numbers.
Thanks.
And kudos to you for writing that. My question is this. The title of your book is Real Sex. And then right under that, you have a subtitle called The Naked Truth About Chastity. And you do a great job defining what chastity is. But I kind of never really found out what the naked truth is about chastity.
The naked truth is a marketing spin created by the marketing department. I did have something to say about the title. I don't remember that I had anything to say about the subtitle. So if pressed, if held accountable to my subtitle, I guess I would actually say that I think the naked truth comes in chapter 8. I mean, part of what I was, for those of you who have not read the book, there is a chapter where I really try to offer a theological account of the essentialness and absolute importance of singleness to the church and to God's economy. And that was a real aim that I had. I get very, very, very angered by the kind of marriage idolatry in Christian communities. I mean, I think lots of people will marry. Lots of people desire to marry, and that's great, and marriage is hard, and the church should devote energy to helping people marry and stay married well. At the same time, it seems to me in such theological error and so unscriptural and so discounting the fact that Jesus, Dan Brown notwithstanding, was himself, you know, life most fully lived and single, that I just go ballistic at the kind of unwillingness to admit that just to explore why singleness actually is clearly from the New Testament an essential piece of what the church is about. And I think part of what is lost when we do this Protestant marriage obsession thing is we get very quickly, it's back to the purity thing and whether we're just this pure community who hangs out with each other. Because then we start thinking that the way we make Christians is to get married and have babies, which is not how we make Christians. We make Christians by being hospitable to the stranger. Now, one way of being hospitable to a stranger is to have a child, right? That's like pretty radical hospitality to a total stranger. It is. And it's a stranger that doesn't leave, right? But that is not the only way of extending hospitality to a stranger. And as my colleague at Duke, Stanley Harawas, says, part of what is radical about Christianity, and what he doesn't add this, but one of the ways that Christianity actually really is different from Judaism, I'm big into pointing out the ways that Christianity and Judaism are quite similar, but there are some differences, and one has to do with this question of family. So as my colleague Stanley Harawas points out, Christians have to believe that it could be the case that every Christian in a single generation would be called to lifelong celibate singleness, and the church would obtain into the next generation because the way we make Christians is by showing hospitality. So I think that's part of the naked truth. I guess I would add a second naked truth, which may not please everyone here. And that is... the truth that chastity is difficult and may rightfully involve suffering. I think suffering, I know I just sound like I'm picking on the church, which I guess I am. This is like thing number 10 that I wish the church would do differently. I think, again, in sort of broadly speaking, evangelical North America, we have absorbed this idea and we perpetuate this idea that if I'm a good Christian and if I do the Christian life thing right, that I will be blessed by a life that is happy. Now, it seems to me very scriptural, actually in some troubling and confusing ways to me, that God blesses the faithful. And that certainly, particularly in certain kinds of biblical literature, that idea, Proverbs, for example, that idea is there. But it also seems clear that blessing is not equated with lack of suffering, and that, you know, we are called on a long and narrow road. And I think in our time and place, people sometimes say to me, actually, I thought this is where you were going to go with the Old Testament thing. People sometimes say to me, well, in the Old Testament days, people got married when they were 12. So can we really be called to chastity now that we don't marry until we're 37? You know, and how do I deal with that struggle? And part of it is, I mean, I know you're thinking easy for me to say because I'm married, but, you know, I think this is a site of real suffering in our generation. And I would say, actually, that may be true for a lot of married people also. I mean, that chastity is something to which we're all called, and it's not that much easier to figure out a kind of salutary and faithful marital sexual life than it is to figure out how to do the single and not having sex thing. So it seems to me, I guess when I think about this, I often come back to the story of blind Bartimaeus, who is restored to sight and follows Jesus, like that's where his story ends. And then in the next chapter, like where's Jesus going? He's going to Jerusalem to die. So where's Bartimaeus following him? Like Bartimaeus is not following him around the Galilee while he heals people. Bartimaeus is restored to sight and follows Jesus on a road that leads to suffering. So I don't think chastity is the only area or the most important area of suffering in our lives, but I think it can be that, and that doesn't mean that it's not a fruitful, blessed path. It just means that we are completely incorrect when we think that because we go to church a lot and give money to church and do good Christian things that we ought to be happy. That was a really optimistic note to like conclude our evening on, wasn't it?
I think it was quite good. I think we have time for one more. Kelly, you can be our final.
Well, ironically, this isn't really a question. It's more a thank you, because I, too, am one of those people who have read a lot of books. And I am tired of the lack of authenticity and honesty. And I just think that both in the way you've presented what you've shared today and in your book, there's a huge number of people who have been really blessed by just telling the truth, you know? And so, thank you.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it.
I think that's a good, great place to end. And guess what? The best news is that we get her tomorrow, too. So
come
the
back.
Conversation continues. So can we express to Lauren our gratitude?
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks for all the good questions. Thanks for not answering your cell phone in the middle of the event.
And I think that's all for tonight. So please feel free to come back tomorrow and don't come to every service, because that will be a problem. But sometime tomorrow, come back and join us 9, 11, 5:30, and have a good night and be safe.